This is Jim Inkster, and happy Independence Day. Glad you're joining us on a holiday, and hope you enjoy the 4th of July. Signature support for our program is from the Mayor's Office of East Baton Rouge Parish, and our show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757 is our number, and we're joined to start our show today with two gentlemen who will talk about music. And, of course, this is a festive time in our country, and two people who know the terrain well. Philip Manuel, the fabulous vocalist from New Orleans, who's been doing his thing for about a half century, and John Word, who's been reporting about music in our world for 32 years in Louisiana. They are with us to talk about what's going on, and this is a day that has special relevance, not only as the birthday of our country, but we'll get with John and Philip about the relevance of July 4th to music. But this week, the number one jazz recording of all time took place July 1, 1959 on 30th Street at CBS headquarters in New York City. Take Five from Dave Brubeck, Paul Desmond, and it is certainly a piece of music that has stood the test of time. Philip Manuel, I know your friend Bill Grimes loved Take Five, and it is one that,
yep.
It's an irresistible sound.
Yeah, what's so odd, Jim, is that the song wasn't well received initially. I'm just kind of reading, doing a little research on it, and Desmond considered the track a throwaway at first, but go figure.
Well, the song is written in the key of E minor in quintuple time, and for those who are music aficionados, this was like cutting edge stuff. And the other day, I heard the son Chris Brubeck saying that they gave up after the first try. They were so confused that they couldn't even handle it themselves.
Yeah, they originally recorded it, I think, on June the 25th. And then they came back and did two more versions on July 1st. And you know, they got it.
They got it. And John, the quartet, the Dave Brubeck Quartet, first played Take Five for a live audience at the Newport Jazz Festival on July 5th, 4 days later, 1959. So tomorrow will be 65 years that the world heard Take Five for the first time.
That's a quick turnaround. And you know, as Philip was saying, and you were saying, something unusual about the piece is it's composed in 5/4 time, and 4/4 time is the common time in signature, it's the common time signature in pop music, which is 4 beats to a measure. But this song is, or this instrumental piece is 5 beats to a measure, so it was kind of tricky. And something Chris Brubeck said on NPR the other day was his dad was listening to African music, which by European standards has atypical time signatures.
Well, this was from the album Time Out, which is one of those that has certainly stood the test of time. 65 years ago, the best-selling jazz recording of all time, Take Five and Robin Dow. Let's go to the archives and hear a bit of the fabulous single by the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Paul Desmond, of course, was the alto saxophone artist on this, and Dave Brubeck at the piano, Joe Morello drums, and Gene Wright bass. They were quite a quartet. John, I think it is fair to say they have held up well through the years.
One of the classic quartets in jazz, and Paul Desmond, of course, the alto saxophonist, and he's the guy who brought two themes to the session for what was going to become Take Five. And the group worked it out together and created Take Five, a classic. So it'd be nice to hear Paul's saxophone, because that's the real melody of the song.
Well, we might be able to hear a bit more of it as we move along with you and Philip on this show this morning, and happy 4th of July. But the single was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1966. It's, of course, received more airplay than any jazz recording of all time, and it's a lesson that you just never know. Here is a hidden jewel that who would have thought, John?
That's right. Again, Paul Desmond didn't think there was anything to it. As Philip said, he thought it was a throwaway. And they don't even know, neither Paul nor Dave Brubeck or anybody in the group knows exactly why the song was so popular, but it's just so catchy, and it's got that cool melody on the saxophone. So, yes, it worked, as Paul Desmond said. It just worked.
And as you noted, it was first recorded on June 25th, but it proved so arduous that after 40 minutes and more than 20 failed attempts, the producer suspended the effort because the members kept losing the beat. And the iteration of the tune used a different rhythmic groove than the final version. And the final version is one that is magnificent. But that group, you know, after they did that, they went on. And, of course, Desmond is a legend. Brubeck is. And but it's hard to repeat that kind of success, isn't it?
They got lucky on this, or they put it all together in a way that just became irresistible, because it, as you said, it's the best-selling jazz single of all time. And go back to 1959, we're talking about 45 RPM vinyl records. So it seems unusual to me that even a jazz piece would be released as a single, but in 1959, that sort of thing was possible.
Well, the piece was apparently the inspiration of the drummer, Joe Morello, who wanted to showcase his ability. And, of course, you hear his drum playing on take five. But Brubeck delegated Paul Desmond to write a tune using Morello's rhythm. And Desmond composed two melodies, which Brubeck arranged. And the rest, as they say, is history. But this is also the 4th of July, and there'll be a big celebration at the library later today. It's 7 o'clock. And then after that, you can go downtown and see the fireworks. And patriotic music is always, always worth hearing, and especially so on this day. July 4, 1776 was Independence Day. And Robin, let's go to John Philip Sousa with perhaps the most well-known patriotic song of all time. Hard not to get pumped up when you hear that. And John Wirt, you and I were of a vintage born not so long after World War II, and the patriotic fervor was such that that song was played probably a bit more then than now, but even now I get goosebumps when I hear it. And that was from John Philip Sousa, who was the head of the Marine Corps band in the late 1800s. So he left a mark, shall we say, an even bigger mark than Paul Desmond and Dave Brubeck.
Sure enough. That's I'm sure you still hear it everywhere on July 4th, of course.
Okay. And Philip Manuel is with us from New Orleans. We lost him for just a moment, but we were commenting about the patriotic music that we hear at this time of the year, Philip. And I know you're an aficionado of all kinds of music, from Andy Williams to John Philip Sousa.
Don't give me that much, Jim. I know jazz music a bit. I know R&B a bit. I'm not nearly as versed on patriotic music as I probably should be, even though I've done some great American songbook kinds of concerts in my time.
Well, we live in a city that, of course, is synonymous with horn playing and Louis Armstrong. And for years, it was thought that Louis was born on the 4th of July. Now his official birth date is listed as August 4th. But you talk about a guy who represented Americana. I don't know of anybody who embodied it more than Satchmo, Philip.
No, I absolutely agree. And, you know, I listened to Wynton Marsalis talk about Louis Armstrong, and he first talked about how he didn't really appreciate him, and then how that changed from lack of appreciation to just absolute wonder at what Louis Armstrong represented and how he played, and the simplicity of his genius. And I think you're right. Louis Armstrong really represented the best in America. I really do.
Well, we'll have more Talk Louisiana after this 89.3 second timeout. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on the 4th of July. And this was the birthday of Bill Withers, William Harrison Withers Jr., and we're going to get Philip Manuel's take on him. He loves his music, and I think he has a Bill Withers song on his upcoming album, but Bill Withers was born on this date in 1938 in Slab Fork, West Virginia. He died the 30th of March, 2020 in Los Angeles. He was 81 years old. But John, before we get to Bill Withers, it was thought Louis Armstrong was born on the 4th of July, but then there was exhaustive research and now we know otherwise. How did we find out?
Well, it wasn't really exhaustive research. It was almost an accident. Now, Tad Jones was a music historian, author, and instructor at UNO, and he discovered the correct date of Armstrong's birth. So in 1988, Tad followed a clue he found in a French biography of Armstrong. The clue led him to search baptismal records at Sacred Heart of Jesus Church in New Orleans, and those records cite Armstrong's birthday as August 4th, 1901. And, you know, by the way, Ted's writing credits include one of the best histories of New Orleans music. It's called Up from the Cradle of Jazz. And it was co-written with one of your frequent guests, Jason Berry, as well as John Foose. But Tad Jones had surmised that Armstrong lied about his age because he wanted to enlist in the U.S. Army. So that's Tad's theory about the reason.
4 August 1901, which would mean that Barack Obama was born on Louis Armstrong's 60th birthday, and there is some poignancy in that.
I'm glad you put that together.
August 4th, 1961.
That's rich.
But I mentioned Bill Withers, and he had some pipes that were incredible, and the best pipes I've ever heard in Louisiana are by those from our friend in New Orleans, Philip Manuel. And I know you have great reverence for the late, great Bill Withers.
Well, he was an uncommonly talented songwriter, first and foremost. I mean, some people would say that his pipes were just okay, but his pipes were great for what he wrote, and he never needed to sing anything but what he wrote, because what he wrote was so seminally important, and just It was just the best. I mean, he's not in the Songwriters Hall of Fame for nothing. He just wrote some unbelievable music.
Well,
simple. You know, I find that the best stuff is simple, and but the simplicity, there's a profoundness in the simplicity, if you can say it that way. And Bill Withers embodied that. You know, you're right. I do have one of his songs on my new record that I'm working on. It's called Hello Like Before.
Yeah, that's a good one. But if you hear Bill Withers do Lovely Day, you know, I mean, he could hit some notes.
Yeah, there's only one.
But he also did a song that you and I, and I think any guy can relate to this song in one way or another. And we've been on both sides of the coin, but here is a song Philip talked about a few years ago that Robin Dow has pulled up. She likes it too. Here we go, Bill Withers.
A man we passed just stare me down. And when I looked at you, you looked at the ground. I don't know who he is, but I think that you do. Dadgum it, who is he and what is he to you? I had something in my heart and in your eyes. Tells me he's not someone just passing by.
How about those lyrics, Philip?
Wow, what a, I mean, just from an incident, walking with your girl, you see a guy, there's that second where eyes meet, and he creates this unbelievable lyric about that simple incident. I mean, I'm reading a book now by Rick Rubin called The Creative Act, A Way of Being, and Bill Withers, I mean, he just embodies how he let the universe come in through him and write these unbelievable songs.
And he had few peers. I think he ranks as one of the greats. And you mentioned it. He not only was a great vocalist, he wrote this stuff, and he was a guitar player. I remember when Rosie Grier was pursuing Denise Nicholas at the same time, who ultimately married... married Bill Withers. Rosie Grier tried to take up the guitar. I think there was a little more to Bill Withers' magic than the guitar, but he had it all. And he was one of those guys who could have made a fortune if he had gone on tour, but he kind of just went away. And I like that. I actually like what Johnny Carson did, and I like what Bill Withers did.
Yeah, Bill Withers understood that the art was... artists make art for themselves first and foremost. And, you know, he understood that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with sharing it. You have to share it, but you don't create thinking of attention and thinking of fame and fortune. You create because you have to. And Bill Withers understood that as well as anyone.
And on this day, 21 years ago at Cedars-Sinai Medical in Los Angeles, Barry White died. He was only 58 years old. As we know, he was an immense person, but also an immense talent. And the man from Galveston, Texas, John, he certainly was emblematic of the era that he was a performer, and few did it like Barry White.
Yes, something about Barry White and Bill Withers. They're two rhythm and blues artists working big time in pop music at the same time, but they're so different. So I really admire that about these two artists. And Barry White was more smooth and romantic and very contemporary in his disco orientation. And Bill Withers, again, was so soulful in his songwriting. It was amazing.
Well, Philip, if it was romance, it was in your face with Barry White. There wasn't left much. Nope. There wasn't much left of the imagination, was there?
No question about it.
Well, we thank both of you, gentlemen, and Robin's going to close with Barry White. But, Philip, I know you've got a performance coming in a few days, and tell us where you'll be in the great city of New Orleans.
Well, I'll be in Ann Arbor, Michigan on the 12th and the 13th at the Blue Llama. And then I'll be at Snug Harbor on July 20th, and I'll be at the Satchmo Fest on August the 3rd.
Okay, so a day before Satchmo's birthday, and July 20th at Snug Harbor, which is a place where Philip Manuel is synonymous with some of the great acts who perform there. And we're glad you still do it a few times a year. And keep going, my friend. Both of you.
You're both a
treasure to our state. And as we close this segment, let's go to the remarkable and the lasting voice of Barry White.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. As many times as we've loved and we've shared love and made love, if doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough, baby. It's just not enough. Oh, baby. Oh, baby. My darling, I can't get enough of your love, baby. Girl, I don't know why I can't get enough of your love, baby. Lord, some things I can't get used to, no matter how I try. It's like the more you give, the more I want. And baby, that's no lie. Oh, no, babe. Tell me, what can I say? What am I gonna do? How should I feel when everything is you? What kind of love is this that you're giving me?
And we'll return with more Talk Louisiana after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster, and we're visiting with Michael Castleman now. He has written a compelling book, a sweeping 600-year chronicle of the book business. Publishers Weekly says bibliophiles will be enthralled. It's the untold story of books, and talk about a big topic. Michael Castleman, who's a guy who knows his way around a word or two, he is a guy who's written many previous books, and this one is one that it goes into just about every matter of the written word. And congratulations on this fine piece. And tell us more about the motivation for taking up a topic which is as large as the world itself.
Well, thank you for having me on, Jim. And thing is, I've written 19 books over 45 years. And when I signed my first book contract and way back in 1979, I thought, gee, maybe I'll be able to get ahead in the book business if I study the book industry. And so I spent 4 decades researching the history of book publishing, which has been largely untold. I mean, most histories of publishing are memoirs by famous editors or writers or publishers, but no one's ever really looked at the whole sweep of 600 years from Gutenberg to Amazon. And so that's what I did. And what's so funny about it, what's interesting about it, is that the book business has basically been ruled by technological change. As printing changed, as printing evolved, fewer people could produce more copies of more books faster and cheaper per copy. And so what happened was, over time, books multiplied and prices went down. And we see that today because there's zillions of ebooks out there for less than a dollar. So the good news is that it's easier to publish books than ever before. But the bad news, particularly for authors, is it's harder and harder to promote them.
Well, you note that Gutenberg, who's credited with the genesis of this around 1450, he went bankrupt, didn't he?
That's right. The book business has been a minefield since day one. Gutenberg went bankrupt. He could not make a living publishing books. His presses were seized and sold to another sold to his creditor, who actually made a go of it by publishing advertising handbills. So from the beginning of printing, it was very profitable to produce advertising flyers and little tracts for the church. But it was not profitable to produce books. And talk to any publisher today, and they'll tell you it is very difficult to publish profitable books. Books are a tough sell. I mean, everyone loves books. Books are a foundation of culture. We revere books, but they're hard to sell.
Well, you note, Michael Castleman, that in 1800, the U.S. population, when Thomas Jefferson was elected president, was 5 million, about the size of Louisiana, of which 2 million could read, and the biggest book town by far was Boston, with a population of 25,000. But this was pre-electronic media, so books were a big deal, weren't they?
Yes, well, books have always been revered, as I mentioned. Books are a talisman. They're a token, a totem of culture. But they're hard to sell. I mean, in colonial times, There was no shipping. There was no distribution. It was almost impossible to move books, which are quite heavy. If you've ever moved where you live, I'm sure you've lugged boxes of books. They're very heavy.
They are.
So at every turn, books are difficult to move. They're difficult. They used to be difficult to publish, and they've always been difficult to sell. That doesn't devalue them at all, but what it does is it shows that it's a tough road. And I wrote this book because so many authors complain about how hard it is to write and publish and sell books. And the whole point of The Untold Story of Books is that it's always been that way. It's always been tough. It's never easy being an artist in any of the arts, music, dance, acting, writing. The arts are tough, the arts are cruel, and yet we love them, and I keep writing despite how daunting the challenge. I'm going to keep writing till I die.
Well, isn't it interesting, though, that in 1800, Boston had 25,000 people and 30 booksellers. So according to my math, that's more than one per thousand residents. It isn't like that today. And as much as our machines and our gadgets have helped us consume information, for those of us who like to pick up a book, savor it, treasure it, go through it time and time again, those days may be waning.
They're changing. The book business is always changing. The book business is a kaleidoscope of change.
The book is The Untold Story of Books, A Writer's History of Book Publishing, Michael Castleman, who lives in the great city of San Francisco. And you knew that, or you write, that by 1850, the United States had perhaps the largest literate population on earth, and that may explain why our country has endured, because as we know, knowledge is power. But how did it happen? Why was there this intellectual curiosity that we had as Americans that perhaps other countries did not have as much?
Well, I think all countries have had a lot of curiosity about knowledge and have always welcomed books into their lives. And what happened in the United States was we had laws that required public education. And so publishers rush in to try and fill the need and give us an enormous variety of books. But it's hard to sell them. And authors find that out the hard way.
Well, you note that Carnegie built 1,689 libraries. This had to be a big catalyst for having a population that was interested in reading.
Oh, absolutely. Carnegie built the library that's six blocks from my house in San Francisco. Carnegie libraries filled the nation with books. Millions and millions of books were purchased to fill Carnegie libraries. And so publishers loved the fact that Carnegie created so many libraries because then librarians filled them with their books. And that's still happening today. Libraries, I just went to the American Library Association convention, and let me tell you, there's the world of libraries and books is very rich, even though people predicted the end of printed books with the arrival of ebooks, but that simply has not happened. Ebooks turn out to account for only about 15% of book sales. People love holding books in their hands, and printed books still account for 85% of books bought in the United States.
85%, that's a healthy number. Well, you note that after World War I, that paperbacks got a life of their own.
Yes, paperbacks have a long and tortured history. They started out as little cheap things on very coarse paper. You might have heard the phrase pulp fiction. That's because the paper that cheap books were printed on was made out of wood pulp, sawdust. And the pulp paper was developed in the early 1800s. And that was the beginning of paperback books. But paperback books as we know them did not really happen until after World War II. When printers found a way to manufacture cheap paperback books that were well made, well bound, and easy to read, And that led to the paperback revolution in the United States, which really hit in the early 1960s as the baby boom generation came of age. Paperbacks quadrupled book sales. In the 1960s, book sales exploded in the United States, in part because paperbacks were cheap and in part because the baby boom generation started to buy them.
Well, you have not only a recap of how it all began, where it's gone since, but also the business. It is a business, and in some areas still a thriving one, but there are some challenges. How is that aspect looking these days?
The book business is a business, and a lot of people think that because they love books, the book business must be a sort of gentleman's, very nice and everybody getting along kind of thing. Absolutely not. The book business is like a brawl. Publishers fight each other all the time. They fight bookstores. Business is contentious, and the book business is the same. And what's happening now is that we have so much centralization of book sales in Amazon that Amazon single-handedly killed 75% of neighborhood bookstores in the United States from 1994 to 2010. Three-quarters of independent booksellers went out of business because of Amazon. Now, booksellers are rebounding a little, but Amazon accounts for about half of book sales in the United States. And if you look at ebooks, Amazon accounts for about two-thirds of them.
And you leave us with these observations that authors will continue to write, and Michael, nothing can kill books.
That's right. Every new form of technology, radio, television, the internet, TikTok, every time there's a new communications technology introduced, people predict the end of books. Oh, books can't compete with television. Oh, books can't compete with the movies. Actually, books have competed very well with all new media. Nothing can kill books. Books are resilient. And as for authors, authors are resilient too. I look out there and the book business is very challenging, very daunting. Does that stop me from writing? Absolutely not. I love to write. Millions of Americans love to write. We keep writing. Yes, it's tough to get published. Yes, it's harder than ever to publish, promote books. But the joy of writing and seeing your work published compensates for all of that.
The book is The Untold Story of Books from the fascinating Michael Castleman, who has taken a topic not easy to write about, and he's done it like nobody else could. Thank you, sir, and congrats on your work.
Thank you.
This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana, and we're privileged now to visit with one of the fine writers in America, Jacqueline Gay Wally. She's written 8 books, and the latest is now in paperback, The Wah, A Creative Individualistic Woman Risks Everything, Following a Vision to a Place That Ends Up Changing Her to a New, True, Risky, Loving Self. That's the setup. It's quite a story, and it's been portrayed, Jacqueline, as part of your research on the psychology of nomads. Tell us more.
Okay. Well, the part of the nomad, first of all, the WAW, W-A-W, what that really means, it's what the sub-Saharan nomads call the ultimate oasis, which doesn't really exist, but it's sort of out there. And I got interested in the whole concept of nomads, people who can't be colonized, people who have their own sources to be their real selves. And so in the book, it's not necessarily about, you know, getting out there and traveling the desert or living in many places. It's about internally being an uncolonized self, somebody who is truly themselves. And in the book, my main character goes off after a vision and moves to this island in England that actually doesn't really exist, and she meets people and learns more about herself in solitude and in community, and is transformed by following an inner vision, following an inner journey, so to speak.
Well, this is a departure from probably the way we're taught to advance in society, but there are many ways to advance as humans, and I gather, based on what you're saying, is that this may be unconventional, but sometimes it's a good thing to do, to test boundaries and to go in directions that people don't anticipate.
Exactly, and it doesn't have to be moving. You know, this is an inner journey in a certain way. It doesn't mean, it doesn't mean that you have to give up your job and run away. It means that just you're following your own inner, your own intuition about who you are. And when you do that, you come to some new places.
And your main character leaves New York to go across the pond.
That's
not like going from New York to New Jersey. That has to be for somebody who does it, and there are people who do. That has to be quite a moment of contemplation to make that move.
Right. She doesn't exactly pick up and go forever. She follows the vision. She keeps her place in New York, and she does come back and forth, and she realizes because of her career that she can't just leave. So she goes, but she follows, she knows that she's searching for something, and she follows that inner vision, and she doesn't quite know why she's doing it at all until she gets there. And she does go back and forth to New York because of work.
Well, she has a boyfriend in New York who visits, and this affects him a lot too, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, his true colors show up, and then she happens to meet another man who is more suited to her when she's there.
And falls in love.
Yes, and she falls in love, yes.
How important is this to the main character and to the story as a whole?
Well, I think if you're going to become your true self, so to speak, metaphorically, you are going to attract and be attracted to somebody who's going to reflect that. Whereas in the story, the boyfriend is after something else. He's more opportunistic and more, he's not really a true partner, so to speak. And she meets somebody who, one of the facets in the book about this new person is that he is kind of quiet. And they, when they meet, it's very sort of quiet between them. And that allows sort of soul movement to connect.
The book is The Waw, W-A-W, from Jacqueline Gay Wally, and it is a story about transformation in life and the odyssey that her main character takes, which is unconventional. And based on what you have created with your imagination and with, I presume, a part of your own life, would you recommend this course for others?
I would recommend for others to listen to their intuition and whatever that may be and follow that. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to run away to England, but it does mean that when one has undiscovered parts of oneself to follow through.
Well, it always helps to have a partner. I hate the term soulmate, but that's what some people call it. But is that a necessity?
Yeah.
Can we find ourselves without appendages?
Absolutely. It's an inner journey. I mean, in fact, in the book, she's very moved by beauty. She's very moved by friendship. She's very moved by music. And all these things create the wall in her.
Well,
in all of us.
Tell us about your main character. This has to be somewhat partly Jacqueline.
Yeah, well, she is partly Jacqueline in some ways. Not that I ever went and did that, but... Well, I think that, you know, writers tend to be rather internal. So she's somewhat internal, and I'm very much a lover of music, and very much there are people that I truly connect with, and she does on this island. There are three very interesting people who bring her out of herself and make her see new things. And I'm sort of like that. I'm open to that.
Well, Jacqueline is a prolific writer, and this one has been described as a creative, individualistic woman risks following a vision to a place that ends up changing her to a new, true, risky, loving self. I think that's an apt description of The Waw. But when I told someone you were a guest that would be on our show soon, they were familiar somewhat with your work. And as I say, you've written 8 books, but also, among others, How to Write a First Novel.
That's right. Yeah,
yeah. That's something I'm sure a lot of people are interested in. They have imaginations, we all do, and some of them would like to have them bloom on the pages of a book.
Yeah, that book's on, it's an ebook. It's on Book Boon, and one can download it from Book Boon. I don't think it costs much money at all. And well, I actually coach writing, so I work a lot with people trying to realize their dream as a writer and bring the story to life. So I wrote the book to have a sort of wider help, a wider audience. And right is a little bit like going to the wall. You're following a vision.
And Jacqueline is a triple threat. She's done books, e-books, and a film, The Erotic Fire of the Unattainable. I tell you, if the title doesn't catch you, nothing will. I'm interested. Tell us about this.
That film is on Amazon Prime now. That film I even acted in it. That film was based on a book I was writing. I never put it out because the film kind of did it. And it was 3 ways of looking at love. One was when you love somebody more, the other is when somebody else loves you more, and the third was supposed to be when it's right. But that isn't what happened in the film, but that was the concept behind it. So it was sort of 3 ways of looking at love with the same person.
Jacqueline was born in London, raised in Montreal, and lives in New York. So those are three of America's, or three of the world's great cities. How do you compare them?
Well, I was a child, actually, when I left London. I grew up in Montreal. Montreal's a beautiful city, very beautiful. And as you know, it has a French influence. And it's a nice city to grow up in. Canada's a gentle place. And it's very pretty. New York is, as we all know, a workout. And but it's it's true what they say about New York. It has this kind of energy about it. And you get hooked on it.
Well, we're glad you've joined us today, and congrats on The Wah, now in paperback, a compelling novel, The Eighth, from Jacqueline Gay Wally. It's been a pleasure, Jacqueline.
Thank you so much for having me and letting me talk to your people.
Best to you. And special people indeed. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back tomorrow with Friday Politics. Hope you enjoy your 4th of July, and please, you have spent part of the day with us. Happy Independence Day, and one last time, let's go back to the year of 1959, Dwight David Eisenhower was president of the United States of America, and Dave Brubeck and Paul Desmond hit it big with Take 5. Until tomorrow, for Robin Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Be safe and stay tuned.